Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Thanks, everybody, for biting on my little practice throw out there. But let's turn the time over to Maxine for her. Maxine, if you're ready, I'd love it.
Well, you know, in talking about how to reframe this current crisis that we're experiencing of church discipline suddenly descending, you know, on John Dolan and Kate Kelly and Rock Waterman and possibly a few others, I thought I would share two ways that I automatically tend to reframe it. Just because I'm older, I've been around since the 70s, and I've kind of not only studied history and written about it, but sort of became part of it. And I've lived through the events of the 70s as a feminist back then, and again, the 90s as a feminist, and then now. So I have kind of an automatic reframing that happens within me. And I thought I would mention two aspects, sort of course, the larger historical view that gives me a different framing, partly because I've experienced it and partly because I've studied it. And then also the larger narrative view, multiple narratives coexisting. So I thought I would just chat about those two aspects for a bit. In terms of the larger historical perspective, you know, right now is a very scary time because for the last 10 years, we've been experiencing all this historic progress since 2000. More tolerance, more diversity, more scholarship, more feminism. And we sort of felt like we were in a whole new era. And then all of a sudden this year, that progress feels challenged by this sudden backlash against John and Kate and Rock and others. And I guess what I want to try to share with people to give a slightly different framing to this is, even though it's terrible and it's awful and we're all kind of reeling from this, at the same time, in a very odd but real way, it's normal. It's always been this way in Mormon history since Mormon origins in 1824. Progress and backlash coexist all throughout LDS history. And you don't have one without the other. So it's, you can kind of relax a little bit and realize this is normal. I mean, whether you're talking about Joseph Smith and his innovations or the church, the way that it was evolving and growing so rapidly and the constant backlashes that it was experiencing as a young radical church, or whether you're talking about feminism, you know, women's experience and authority and evolution in the church, you know, you can look at the historical arc of women's experience and authority and empowerment and agency in Mormonism. And it's a story of progress and backlash coexisting all the time, so that you would have, for example, women's spiritual empowerment, blessings, speaking in tongues, having visions, you know, in the 30s, in the first decade of the church in Kirtland. And at the same time, there were backlashes. I mean, you had the terrible violence that was happening in Missouri. And then in the 40s, you see the Relief Society emerging as this powerful order of priestesses. And then you see, of course, at the same time, the tensions of polygamy and conflict, and then the Relief Society being disbanded and Brigham Young, you know, formally telling them to go away and not come back in 1845 until he told them that he was ready for them to come back. I mean, you see this kind of coexistence all the way through. You see it in the 1870s and 80s, the Relief Society is finding so much empowerment and progress, and with the vote and with the women's exponent and giving blessings and on and on. And then at the turn of the century, actually starting in the 80s, you see male church leaders' rhetoric pushing back, trying to limit their agency and their exercise of priesthood power and authority. And you see it at the turn of the century. I mean, you see in the 20s, 1920s and 30s, social feminism and social feminist efforts and projects. But at the same time, you see Emmeline Wells released in 1921, which is a huge backlash against
her. Yeah, I learned something the other night. I guess I maybe if I ever knew it, I'd forgotten a bit. But you're saying up until her, every single Relief Society president was called for life.
Yeah, the calling of president of the Relief Society was a lifetime calling, which is why you don't see Eliza R. Snow formally ordained, and the word was ordained, until, I want to say, is it 1884, anyway, the 1880s. She's ordained the year after Emma Smith dies.
So she'd been functioning, but never ordained, right?
Yeah, Eliza R. Snow had been functioning as de facto or informal Relief Society president, but she wasn't formally ordained as Relief Society president.
Until Emma died, Emma was the original one, yeah.
Yeah, the year after.
Yeah, so anyway, it amplifies that it was much more similar to the prophet, but for the women's priesthood orders.
Right, and that gets into Relief Society minutes and how they configure women's authority, which is a whole other topic that's really interesting. But anyway, so this simultaneous progress and backlash is just a given in life, in religion, yeah, in Mormonism, yeah, and in Mormon feminism. And you see it again, you know, like the 40s, the 1940s, you see this huge rise in sister missionaries where 40% of the missionary force is women, partly because of World War II and, you know, the Rosie the Riveter pattern, while men go off to war. And then the 50s, you see this setback, this retrenchment of women's roles again. And then in the 60s and 70s, you see Mormon feminism happening in dialogue and the Women's Exponent and, you know, women's voices really coming forward and feminist voices coming forward. And yet at the same time, in 1970, the Relief Society's authority and autonomy is ended. So 1970 marked sort of the end of Relief Society autonomy and its full and final incorporation into male priesthood correlation. And yet at the same time, what happens is independent feminism jumps off. And in the 70s, independent feminism flourishes right after this backlash against the Relief Society in 1970. And so you have Women at Dialogue and Sunstone and Exponent 2 all, you know, happening in the mid-70s. And so, again, it's that simultaneous progress and backlash. And then, of course, 1979, huge backlash. Sonia Johnson is excommunicated. She had led the Mormons for ERA, which was another huge feminist push during the 70s. But then backlash, 1979, she's excommunicated. And for me, it was, you know, I lived through it. I was a feminist in the 70s. I was serving a full-time mission in Florida when it was the pivotal state, the final state to decide whether the ERA would pass or not. So I sort of had the Mormons for ERA mission. That was the topic. That was that and the fact that blacks had just gotten the priesthood. I was in Florida in 1979, and the two big topics were, wow, you know, African-American men now have the priesthood, and Sonia Johnson is in big trouble. What's going to happen? And so all during my mission, I was talking to people about was the ERA. Interestingly, for my own balance back then, I had a paradoxical balance because I didn't necessarily support the ERA, but I refused to canvass or work against it. Church members were expected and missionaries were expected to work against the ERA, and I refused to do that. And I refused to, you know, to be used by the church to work against either the IWI or the ERA, even though I wasn't sure that I really supported the ERA because I was draft age. And I, back then, I thought, ugh, I don't want to be drafted. So it was very real for me. But anyway, long story short, when Sonia was excommunicated in 79, I was on my mission, and we were all watching this story. You know, it was huge. And we all got together at a member's house to watch the news and watch what happened. And it hit us all like a ton of bricks. It was traumatizing for all of us. Everybody, whether you supported the ERA or not, we all were traumatized by her excommunication. I'll never forget it. And so you have this huge event, this huge backlash. But contrary to sort of, I think, the more simple narrative that we hear about the backlashes, feminists didn't go away. You know, 1980 was this huge jump in independent feminism, particularly in discourse about the mother in heaven. So in the 1980s, beginning in 79, coinciding with her excommunication, you see really important work about the mother in heaven suddenly emerge that same year, and in 1980 as well. And so the 80s, you see this huge resurgence of independent feminism. And this continues into the 90s. And then, of course, right at the crest of the wave of this burst of feminism, then you see a backlash in 1993.
Right.
And again, contrary to some of the narratives I'm hearing that are a little more simple about how feminism went away after 1993, went underground, disappeared, not true. Feminist voices continued. We were all continuing in a variety of feminist forums, and we actually did use the internet back then. In 1993, we had Mormonelle and Samuel and ELWC, and we were all, you know, everybody was on there talking, processing like crazy. If we'd had blogs back then, we would have been blogging like crazy. We just didn't have blogs. What we had were websites, and people were starting to experiment with websites. But we continued to give feminist papers and presentations at More Women's Forum and Sunstone. Exponent 2 continued and More Women's Forum Quarterly. We were still going strong, and we had the Mormon Feminist Network that was going strong through the 90s and clear through to 2007. So a lot was happening, and we did have a couple of feminist editorials in 2000 and again in 2007. So there was still a lot happening. But I think, you know, what we've seen now with this current backlash is that people sort of assumed that the backlashes were over and that they just weren't going to happen again.
Right. Yeah, we're too big. We're too powerful now. They'd be so stupid. Didn't they learn their lesson from Prop 8?
Yeah. And what we have seen, so in looking at what was different then and what's different and what's the same, back then it was more, I would say, a minority discourse. It wasn't the critical mass. So that's one big shift. Today, with the internet, with the blogs, we're at a critical mass point in the discourse. The discourse that I think John DeLynn represents and the discourse that Kate Kelly represents. Dissenting.
And we don't mean critical mass like it's now the majority. It's just that it's enough of a percentage.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
A critical mass. So now, rather than being a minority discourse, we've got a huge critical mass discourse out there on the internet. And with John representing all the voices who are wrestling with doctrine and history, and Kate representing, you know, in many ways, feminists wrestling with their authority and, you know, what is their relationship to priesthood. But, you know, in terms of what's different and what's the same, I just want to say one other thing about this historical, kind of larger historical view, that each generation, you know, whether we're talking the 1920s or the 1970s or 1990s or today, those are very different times, very different people. They're very different discourses because the discourse evolves and the collective evolves. And so we're talking different landscapes. It's like the group's psyche and the discourse evolves over time. And so we're talking about very different landscapes, I would say. But what's the same is that the same questions and tensions and problems come back and have to be revisited in a new time, a new generation. And I'm hoping that this is actually comforting to people to think about it this way, because there's no way around it. Those problems and tensions and questions have to come back every generation, every 20 or 10 years, because they have to be revisited in a new time and a new landscape by new people to find out, how will we deal with it this time? Will we deal with it the same way we did last time? Or have we, since we're in a new place and a new time, will we deal with it differently? And are we ready to solve this now? Are we ready to do it differently? You know, and it's meant to be. It had to happen. You know, John and Kate and the discourses that they're part of they had to happen, because what this does is it shows us who we are today. What is Mormonism today? It shows us where we are today. And it's vital that we see ourselves and that we see who and what and where we are today. And the only way we can know that is to test it and see how we deal with it this time.
So how spectacularly are we failing this test?
Well, and I want to share some perspective on that, because I think that in terms of just sheer numbers, and I'll get to this more in a minute, but today I think we're doing far better with it. I mean, we can ask the question, you know, are we doing better today than we did 20 years ago? Yes. The bar of tolerance is been raised so far above where it was 20 years ago. The dissent, the tolerance, the discussion, the embracing of scholarship, dissenting scholarship, feminism, GLBTQ members, all of these things that were the three greatest dangers in 1993 are much more mainstream now. I mean, the tolerance, the understanding, the inclusiveness is so much greater. And just in terms of numbers, we do have, you know, maybe a half a dozen people facing potential discipline, which is actually a tiny number compared to those who were facing it in the 90s, a very tiny number. And I don't say that to diminish the enormity.
Because you're talking percentage of people involved in these conversations versus what were before. Okay. Interesting.
Right, because just for example, in 1993, the story we always hear is the September 6th. Well, the September 6th was the tip of an iceberg, greatly oversimplified. The reality was that there were dozens of people who were called in at that time, and nearly all of them successfully negotiated their membership. And big names, people who have never come out and admitted that they were called in and that they successfully negotiated their membership. There were only six of us who failed for one reason or another to completely smooth it over and move on. So in addition to the probably three dozen or more, I mean, people who were called in, there were other people too. There were ultra-conservatives who were called in and disciplined. And then there's another huge population of people in the church who were migrating into fundamentalism at that time. Who were disciplined or excommunicated. But just in the liberal feminist subcultures alone, there were dozens. So it was a much bigger crisis of discipline back then.
That's helpful. Thanks.
Yeah. So, and today it's a much smaller number, but it doesn't lessen the severity of the damage. You know, if it's your life that is... It's total. So,
awesome.
One more thing I wanted to say about just the historical big picture before I move on to the narrative big picture is that I think we have to stay focused on not so much what's happened, like, oh, these disciplinary councils have emerged. And I think we need to get a grip on ourselves, don't run around, you know, hand-wringing and fretting. But, realize that this is an opportunity. It's about what we do with this moment. And I liked what Joanna Brooks said. She said, now is the real Mormon moment. I really agree with that. It now is our time to face ourselves and to recognize our responsibility and our agency to make a difference right now, all of us, from, you know, members to leaders. This is a moment where we need to pull together and work together better, pull sides together, bring both sides together. This is our moment to learn what, you know, what we've learned from the last 20 or 40 years and to show what we've learned and to do it differently, all of us. And so what matters is what we do with this moment. And we're mid-process. We're in the middle of it. It's not over. We're right smack in the middle of it. We can pray, we can fast, we can reach out to one another, we can write to our leaders. There's so much that we can do right now.
Cool. Thank you.
Sure.
So you're going to do the competing narratives part now.
Okay. Yeah. So did you want to say anything before I kind of move on to narrative.
I'm good. How about you guys?
They're all asleep.
No, we're just all on
we're
mute.
All on mute. It takes a second to find that button again.
No, anyway.
No, that was
good. One more point I just wanted to say to punctuate the end of that is, and I'll say more about this in a minute, but, you know, I identify with Kate in many ways. There's an interesting way in which Kate's discipline and excommunication revisits mine 20 years ago. And again, I mean, because we were both about the same age, we were both feminists who were challenging women's relationship to priesthood, asking questions, trying to engage it in new ways and ask and assert that women do have a relationship to priesthood. And so this is an opportunity for us to see what has changed in that time. And that's an interesting question too. And I think a lot has changed because, for example, I produced a book and Kate led an organization and did activism. So the church is far more tolerant of activism on Temple Square than, say, it would have been 20 years ago. All I did was a book, you know. Yeah. I mean, I look at the activism Ordained Women has been able to do, and I'm amazed. And and then also just in terms of the boundary, I was reclaiming historic precedent and women's past precedent of exercising aspects of priesthood. We weren't pushing for a new revelation about women and priesthood. And yet, you know, Ordained Women and Kate has been pushing for that or asking, I should say, for it. And to me, that represents a huge, again, shift in progress. That's quite a different project. So even though, you know, obviously this has not gone well, the backlash against Kate is awful. It's undeserved. I was shocked. I didn't expect that. It does bring it all back for me. At the same time, we're mid-process. I'm hopeful, and I'm hoping that we can all still work together to kind of turn this around and have a different end to the story this time in 2014 than we did in 1993, which left gaps and wounds that are still very real, very present with us today. So I want to just talk a little bit too about narrative and how each story is a different narrative, and that we have many different narratives all simultaneous, particularly in terms of sort of this negative narrative that we've been living with about, you know, since 1993, that, you know, if you're doing dissenting feminism or dissenting scholarship, you might be disciplined. But at the same time, that coexists with a positive narrative of progress. And I would say neither is the whole story, and neither one is universal. And I think we have to resist the temptation to view a negative event or a negative narrative as the whole story. Suddenly, the whole world has gone dark, and there's no safety anywhere. There's no progress in the church. It's just like 1993. That's just not true. The positive progress is there, and it's simultaneous, and we can't give ourselves over to this abandon. Nice. To just one narrative. I think about, again, back to 1993, thinking about narratives, people tend to lump the September 6th together as if we were all the same. We had the same narrative, the same story, the same relationship to the church. Not true. Each one of us was totally unique, totally different. We didn't all agree with each other. We were going different directions. And my narrative particularly felt very different from that of the others, but especially in the arc of the time between 1993 and 2011 when I came back. As you mentioned earlier, Dan, I was working with the church on interfaith projects starting in 1999, so I had a very different narrative over that time period. But we all had different narratives, and something that people have not looked at is not only the other narratives of all the other people who were called in and were not disciplined formally, and all the other people who were excommunicated at that same time, but we haven't known the narratives of the bishops and the stake presidents and the high councils who participated in those events. We also don't know the personal narratives of the 70s and the apostles who were involved at that time, what they experienced, what was their story. If a historian really wanted to understand the purge of 93, they would need to interview everybody and reclaim all of those narratives. So we're only seeing a tip of the iceberg, and we think it's the whole story.
Right.
And it's not. You know, we are still discovering all the time pieces of information and parts of stories from 1993. For example, when Phil Lindholm interviewed us and published his book, Latter-day Descent, interviewing people who had been excommunicated in the 90s, that was published in 2011. And I didn't know until I read it that Mike Quinn, Paul Toscano, Levina, and myself had all had a very similar spiritual experience during 1993, that we were all given a spiritual witness that we were going to be excommunicated. I didn't even know we'd all had that experience until I read the book, you know. Or like, I didn't know until recently that Lynn Whitesides had created some healing with the leaders years ago, and she was invited to come back to the church years ago, but she decided not to. Whereas when I went through my healing process and was invited to come back, I decided to come back. So again, there are two very similar narratives that go different directions. One more thing I just want to mention briefly, I want to share, is that I finally last year went back and talked to my old stake president who had excommunicated me in 1993. And for the first time in 20 years, we sat down and had that conversation that we never had.
Yeah, because you chose never to really honor the process, right? You just stayed away from your
Right. I didn't participate in the process, didn't attend my disciplinary council. Anyway, so he and I sat down and talked last December and shared with each other what we had both really experienced 20 years ago. And without going into that, at least at this time, it was mind-blowing because here's this other narrative that's finally recovered. So my point is that we can't make the mistake of thinking that one narrative is the whole story.
Nice, yeah.
Yeah. I think the narrative of progress is real. You know, we've seen extraordinary progress since 2000 with academic conferences on Mormonism, the church stepping up and sponsoring conferences, and also on women's history, and the Joseph Smith papers, the Relief Society Minutes finally coming online in 2010, 2011. I mean, I waited 20 years for that. You know, the church putting online that the Relief Society is ministry, you know, all of these things. There's tremendous progress. It is real, but it does coexist with pockets and stories of disempowerment and repression and rejection. And we need to recognize both. Also, I wanted to mention, for example, my own narrative of return. My narrative of returning to the church in 2012 is a positive narrative that coexists along with the negative. The summer that I came back, there was a huge mass exit from the church. I think the Larsons and their group, there was this mass resignation that same summer, and it was very interesting to me to see my return coexist with that. And I think that, you know, my narrative doesn't diminish anyone else's, but neither does their narrative diminish mine or Don Bradley's, who came back to the church the year before I did. You know, those are positive narratives that reflect the real progress that's happening. But there's also another narrative in there, a narrative of grace, of light, of the Spirit of Christ being alive and well in the church, that God is working in this church and trying to heal the church. And that's another narrative that I need to balance to. And it's real. And it does not diminish or erase the violence done to Kate and her life and her membership. They just simply coexist in this paradoxical way that all of our stories coexist. which no one more than John DeLynn himself has revealed to us in such a beautiful way by recording all of the Mormon stories across the spectrum. He's done a Christ-like act of showing how all these different narratives coexist in our church and that it's dynamic and alive. And to silence his voice would be a great tragedy. So I just want to encourage people to remember that along with the bad news, there's good news too. There's a larger truth that is so much bigger than one narrative, positive or negative, that contains all our stories, and it's dynamic. And I know I've heard some people say that Kate's excommunication means that all feminists are excommunicated. Well, I think we all process our own journey through her and through John and through what they're experiencing. They're a role model. They're symbolic. And we do process through them. But at the same time, by that same logic, you could say that my return to the church meant that feminism is accepted. I was welcomed back to the church exactly as I am, as a feminist theologian, writing, teaching the same things I was 20 years ago. So you could say that that serves as a narrative saying that feminism is now more accepted. But in reality, our stories are our own. My story, John's story, Kate's or Hannah's or Rock's stories are their own. But sometimes we serve as symbols for each other, and we all learn through each other. And I've been learning through Kate and John and what they're going through right now. I'm learning new dimensions of this whole experience. And I think the last thing I want to say is just, again, kind of going back to what Natasha said, I really see, and maybe this is where I get Jungian, I see a group psychology here that the collective consciousness of Mormonism is trying to know itself and see itself. And so it has to confront itself through each of us. Each of us is a part of that collective consciousness. And we are seeing Mormonism through each other, and particularly through the ways that we conflict or confront each other, so that we can know ourselves and integrate, this amazing group psyche.
Thank you, my friend. Wow. Yeah. Powerful stuff. Oh, you guys, this has been so wonderful again. So different than our live one that we did the other night, but just terrific. I'm just going to ask you guys to close with final statements, if you would. But I'm going to be very specific and simply say, all of your great friends, you're all actively committed to these discussions. You're in the fray. You've decided to like it, like Maxine was just saying, to self-assess and see who we are as Mormons, and you're willing, even when the picture's bleak at times, and we have all these competing narratives and whatnot. So where do you get, is it spiritual strength? What is it, emotional strength? What do you draw most of your hope from? So however you want to end up, I want at least an element of that. So should we go in our little zip line here of Natasha, you go first, and then to Rhonda, Chelsea, then Maxine?
Okay, sure. No pressure.
Yeah.
Okay, well, so I'll just close out with some thoughts and then kind of to your spiritual stuff, Dan, that you're asking about. One of the things that I get reminded of a lot, and even in this discussion we had earlier, was the question about, our kiddos. Because it's one thing for all of us to kind of wrestle through a lot of these issues ourselves and try to come out on the other end and figure out, whether we're going to stay or go or somewhere in between. But it's a whole other aspect to then feel like we're going to bring along our kids on this journey that we've all been discussing, that has all these like paradoxes that Maxine has been talking about, and history that all three of the women spoke so well about. And so I just want to just put out there that, first of all, I think that everybody's got to do what's best for them. And that sometimes is hard to figure out. But just because I say something doesn't mean that's the way it should be.
Oh, come on.
But having said that, kids, what we do know about children is that if there's too much stress in their life, too much chronic stress, and by that I mean really toxicity, abuse, these things that are really, really negative, they tend to fail or have a hard time becoming resilient. We also know that on the other side of the spectrum, if there's too little resistance, too little to fight against, too much protection, they also fail to thrive. And so there's this kind of middle ground that's hard to measure, where kids do well. And so I think that being able to bring up children in a culture or a religion or a dynamic where there's push and pull and they have to figure out what they decide and what they believe in and, you know, having to struggle with maybe parents or culture or teachers, etc., is okay. Nobody's going to be probably irrevocably damaged by that. Other than some of these examples that I've given before where they really don't fit the mold and therefore the culture kind of either ostracizes them or pounces on them in some way. So I'm talking about kind of the middle ground here. And so I just say that because I think we've got, and I think all of us have gotten these questions of, okay, maybe I can go to church, but I'm not sure I want my daughters to grow up in an environment where they're going to be, you know, largely seeing their spiritual lens through a patriarchal system. I think that's a valid concern. And again, that's why I say I don't know that there's a best answer to this, but I think it's okay to not want to bring them into this. I also think it's okay to bring them into this and for them to have their own kind of struggle and wrestle with these things, like all of us in this panel have had ourselves.
I appreciate you bringing up that. I think it's true. And just even sitting around the table and modeling how you and your husband, or just having them see how people process different perspectives, is just so important.
Yeah. And we tend to do that, you know, in our family. I mean, every ride home we talk about with our kids, okay, what made you feel the spirit today, you know, and what did you really like, or what inspired you today? We also ask the question of what did you hear that maybe you didn't like today?
Yes.
You know, what scared you, or what, when did you disagree with somebody, you know, and how did you handle that? You know, so those are important conversations that I feel like I need to be having with my children if I'm going to be bringing them into this environment that I think many times is very useful and sometimes can be damaging. And so it's hard because you don't want to take your kids to a damaging location. However, we live in a helpful and damaging world all around us, you know, so whether they're at school or at church or in our own family systems, there's going to be opportunity for health and for damage to occur. And that's why I think these conversations are so important to have with our kids. I also want to say that we've talked a lot about dialogue and communication and how important that is. And I think that a really important thing that brings to the table, and it reminded me as Maxine was talking about, you know, speaking with her stake president, you know, recently, who excommunicated her, is this concept of vulnerability. And that's a very difficult thing for us to manage, is learning how to be vulnerable and taking that risk of connection with somebody that, especially when it doesn't come easy, like I've said before. So I just want to throw a shout out there for validation, or for not validation, for vulnerability. I think that's a really important word to remember. And then the last thing before I go into my, what, testimony, Dan? Is that what you're looking for?
Just like, where are you getting this renewal of energy, you know, when this is no fun? You know, that's okay. What I'm looking for, yeah.
Okay. Well, so one other concept I'd like to leave people with is this concept of personal authority versus group authority. And I do think that that's a paradox also that happens in Mormonism. I think that group authority is okay. I mean, we do need to learn how to function in social settings. We do need to learn how to function in groups and communities and learn rules and behavioral kind of aspects that where we all kind of get along or figure things out. At the same time, it's this personal authority that is so pivotal, I think, to especially people's spiritual journeys. And this is something that I think, again, is very Mormon, where Moroni asks people to pray and ask for themselves, you know, and we have this narrative in our Mormon church that you really can't borrow another person's testimony or spiritual journey. You really have to figure that out for yourself. But then oftentimes we're uncomfortable if that if that person's journey is taking a slightly different direction or a major direction differently than what we think it should be, right? And so that's back to the point of differentiation. But I do think that in our culture currently, and I think Chelsea was mentioning this, we do tend to value group authority versus personal authority more. And I think that's a balance that needs to come back into fruition, where we really can experience our personal journeys and feel free to do that in our I think journey back to God.
Yeah, awesome.
As far as why I stay, I mean, that's an interesting question because, you know, I'm second generation Mormon, so my parents were the converts, and I have said before, well, I started this presentation the other night by saying that I've spent most of my life trying to fit into Mormonism, you know, and figuring out what the family rules were. I'm still not sure I have that figured out. Because I don't come from this history that so many of you share, you know, as far as the pioneer stories and the even the cultural geography that you guys share. I don't come from that. And so it's interesting because as I've transitioned myself, I think faith transition is something we should all be currently doing and are doing, whether we realize it or not. So throughout my own faith transitions, I have felt probably less Mormon and more Mormon than ever before in my life at this current juncture. And it's interesting because when I really look at my spirituality and my relationship with the divine, it is very much through a Mormon lens, and I own that. I claim that. I don't want to give that away. So even though I may not fit in with you guys or have it all figured out, it's still mine, and I'm okay with that. And this is, of course, you know, the beauty of conversion. And then at the same time, I reject your rules often. you know, and I struggle with these types of happenings that we are currently in. But I have to say, I mean, I love the Mormon people. And whether or not I am yet a Mormon people, like Carolyn Pearson owns, when she says, you know, pioneer people, we are. I'm not sure I'm quite that yet, but I'm hanging on, and I love being around you, and I am you in a weird way.
Nice. Yeah. Well, thank you. Thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Thanks for two great conversations this week with you. So love it. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Natasha. Appreciate your comments.
Hey, Rhonda, go for it. Any closing thoughts? Plus, you got to go to my question somewhere along the line.
Okay. Well, first of all, one of your questions was, what about children? And, you know, as a mother of adult children, we've been through a long period of time. But my oldest daughter said, you know, Mom, we always knew that we could come to you and Dad with any questions about the church.
Nice. And
we were not completely traditional, that we were open to questions. And then when some of them have gone through faith transitions, they've known that we were there, even if they didn't necessarily want to talk to us for long hours at the time, but sometimes did. But the other thing that happened is when the disciplinary courts, the letters went out for Kate and John DeLynn, they immediately called and said, Mom, what do you think? They know that we're close friends with John DeLynn and have been for years since he very first started. I met John at Sunstone in 2005 and was arguing for how can we help all of these people that are developing questions and dropping out. There's got to be an internet way of helping them to find a place to go. And it was a valuable place. It has helped many people that. And there are so many that felt alone in their wards, alone in their stakes. And Maxine, when you talked about feminists continued after Sonia Johnson's excommunication, it did for those that were connected. But there were so many outside of the Salt Lake Valley, outside of Utah, that couldn't find those connections. And that's what the internet, the blogger now has done, has made it visible for those that couldn't find the little group that was there. Mm-hmm. And even in 93, the internet was starting. Yes, I was on it, but I still wasn't able to find the progressive Mormon groups at that time. So it was just, it was difficult, very difficult to even navigate. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the, that will continue. The voice, what I have greatest hope for is the opportunity for voice to continue. And for myself, sometimes that's on the internet. I'm not a blogger. I'm not a huge internet person. I'm on there some. But the voice in my ward and in my with my people in my state, that's even more important, because that's what I really value about the church. There's so much I can get from my own study and my own interactions with friends and university, but what the church does for me is gives me a place to be connected and serve when I could easily be just in my own insular world of teaching and publishing and doing my work. And I am grateful for that opportunity to know who's having a baby, who's in the hospital, you know, helping at funerals, for finding the connections at those critical moments in people's lives that I might not be aware of if I didn't have a ward family that I was connected to.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah, that works for me too. I agree with you. I can so easily be lost in headland, yeah, instead of real engaged life land. Yep.
Yeah. That's where I am. I think I'll close with that.
Thank you so much, Rhonda. Amazing. Appreciate everything you do. Chelsea.
Yes, yeah, thank you.
Share away, please.
This has just been so such a fascinating conversation. I'm just grateful to be a part of it. I think my final statement, I think I want to go back to one of the questions that one of the women asked at the conference. And she basically was just saying she's now after the excommunication, she's already kind of a quiet person, and now she's terrified to kind of speak up or go talk to her bishop. She's terrified of like repercussions or being called in and being kind of talked to. And I just want to kind of explain what I said to her, which I think will help me clarify like why I'm still here and doing this. It's been so long.
Mm-hmm.
So what I kind of told to her is when I was first doing LDS Wave, I got called into my bishop, and previous to that moment, I mean, and this is probably when I'm 28 or 29 years old. Previous to that, I had never been called into a bishop. I had always, you know, been kind of terrified of authority figures. I had been just super deferential, and male authority figures especially just sent me into like almost like a social panic, like a phobia. Like I just always wanted to be approved and validated and yes, sir, you know, just kind of, you know, respecting their authority and mantle, and just wanted them to think I was perfect and whatever, just my upbringing. But so getting called into a leader's office to kind of talk about Wave and whether or not he thinks I was wrong or whatever was enormously terrifying. It was so difficult for me. I just wanted to vomit before I walked in the room. I just felt scared. I just felt just so sick to my stomach. And, you know, and at the same time, being the feminist that I am, I was a little bit upset too. I was like, why does he have the right to call me in and question my ideas? And I, you know, that I've not, you know, and so what happened in this moment is we had this exchange where he called me out for a lot of ideas. And in the moment, I just kind of became a little bit more courageous. And I just had the, you know, the way the exchange went down is he asked me, you know, there are some women that are offended by what you're saying. And in my mind, I just had the impression, or I would say I was inspired to quote DNC. I think it's 8210. That's like, if anyone's offended, they should come to you directly. And I kind of quoted him that scripture and verse and said, well, then they should come to me, right? Isn't that how we structure things? And he said, well, no, it's not just one woman. It's over 20 women in the ward are upset by your, you know, feminist ideas. So then I just sat back in my chair and felt just horrible that you know, my ward hated me. And he says they are offended by feminism. They think that it means you hate stay-at-home moms. And I was in the room with my little daughter because at the time I was a stay-at-home mom. And I just kind of, that moment gave me this courage of being like, wait a second. Like, he was completely wrong about feminism and fourth wave feminism and what we thought. And he had clearly never read anything on wave. And it just kind of gave me the courage to kind of stand up for myself a little bit and be like, wait, you're actually not correct in this thing. And have you ever read this? And have I ever said anything doctrinally incorrect? Well, no. And just kind of that practice gave me a lot of strength so that when I went back to church, when I started a new ward, now that there's ordained women and there's lots of social pressure and criticism, I just feel a lot more shielded and protected and able to withstand kind of the questions and comments in a way that I was not before I had that experience. And so part of it's just like getting practice and talking to leaders. And the other thing is just realizing that kind of like Rhonda's been saying the whole time is that every one of us just has a different role. We just have, you know, for some of us, you know, our role is to be in that ward and be super active and participating and be able to contribute to ideas with people who love and trust us. And for me, I felt like that role was kind of taken away from me when my ward turned their back on me. And that was really hurtful. But then it provided this space for me to kind of have a role in a place where I wasn't necessarily scared of the opinions of my ward, you know? So I just kind of look at it too, that maybe each of us are contributing a different place, a different way, just kind of like the body of Christ. Like, I may be, you know, the arm and doing this thing that people might think are weird, but you know what? The church needs it, and we're making it a safer place for a lot of women, and we're making it a safer place for myself. And, you know, and the eye, you know, we need the eyes as well. We need the prophet, and we need, you know, the heart, and we need the women that are serving every single day that don't care about feminism at all. And I think we just kind of need them all. And I think that's why I stay, is primarily this idea that deep, deep down, I just feel like I'm doing the right thing. And I also feel like to my core, I am Mormon and these are my people and this is my culture, and they can, you know, try to kick me out or not want me, but like, I'm not going to ever leave voluntarily. This is my people.
Nice. Yep. Kicking and screaming, but no, beautiful. Thank you so much. Maxine, where would you head out, taking us out of this?
Oh, gosh. Well, first, I just wanted to thank Natasha and Rhonda and Chelsea for spending this time, you know, dishing on all of this. This has been wonderful. We all need so much more of this, you know. I just would love to have more. But I wanted to go back to something Rhonda said, and about how feminism wasn't visible back then like it is now. And she's right. You know, I used to say in the 1990s that feminism was the silent majority in Mormonism. Most Mormon women were feminist but weren't using the label or were afraid to talk about it in public. And now what the blogs and the internet have done is made visible what was there all along. The struggles, the frustrations, the feminism, the resistance, the empowerment, the agency, it was all there, but it wasn't seen. People didn't realize that it was there the whole time and how big it was. And now the blogs and the internet have made it visible. So I want to honor what Rhonda was saying. But for me, this is the most exciting time in Mormon history because it's right now, right? The present is the most exciting time. And I validate, and in fact, I love that word. I use it all the time. But I validate those who leave and those who stay because I've done both. You know, I left.
Nice.
And I came back. And, you know, when I left, I really wanted to leave. I really, really needed a break from the church. And it wasn't the first time. My first time of dropping out of church and wanting a break was back in 1983, 10 years. We called it the mini purge of 83. People don't know about that either. But, and then I came back in the late 80s to work on women in authority. So I had already dropped out once. And, you know, I found that I needed time away where I had total freedom to explore myself and my life. And yet I found that I was spiritually called back to Mormonism in the late 80s and again in 2010, 2011, because Mormonism is an amazing religious tradition. It synthesizes these diverse strands of religious experience and other traditions, Old Testament, New Testament, heretical, esoteric, you know, Masonic, Freemasonic, so many different interesting strands, particularly orthodoxy and heresy. The way that Mormonism marries orthodoxy and heresy is so beautiful. I find it incredibly redemptive and whole. And I love the concept of the restoration. I have this deep, abiding testimony of the power and beauty of the restoration. And I see the potential. I see the fullness of this grand religious experiment or experience that Joseph Smith facilitated. I see it trying to come to a greater fruition and integration. And I feel spiritually called to be part of that, to help that process. And it's very dynamic and exciting. And I see right now is the most exciting time for women, particularly because I see our lost history and authority and access to priesthood coming back. And I feel spiritually called to come back and help with that process. So I feel spiritually called to be here. It's not easy. I'll say it's been hard. It's been harder than I thought it would be. And yet the beauty is that it is hard and it's refining and that I'm learning new things every week and every month of this journey. And I'm not going to give up and I'm not going to stop doing what I'm doing. And what I'm doing is real, and that's how I feel about it.
Awesome. Yeah, that's where it is for me, too. It's just I get enough messages from the universe that I'm doing the right thing at this time, you know, that this is the people that I'm called to be with for better or for worse. And I'm with you. There are so many expansive ideas in Mormonism, and I've thought, and they've sent me into the highest highs as well as, you know, some of the biggest self-examinations and all that stuff possible, but it's a spiritual renewal. You know, I mentioned the other night that in the oath and covenant of the priesthood, which is, you know, really the oath and covenant of God for all of us to receive everything, you know, that God has to give. It talks about the renewing of bodies, and I can just witness for that when you're serving, when you move beyond just willpower, when you've moved beyond just your own resources and your own energy that says, you know, I can make it one more day, or I can do, you know, two more laps or whatever it is, and anything like this, when you serve and when you feel like you're kind of in the place that you're supposed to be, there is a renewal there. So that's what's happening with me.
Love that. I love that. You know, and I want to throw in one more thing along with that. The way that Mormonism embodies the flaws and the beauty, the divine and the human of humanity, the way that it struggles in dynamic tension, you know, our pathologies and our gifts. I just think that Mormonism embodies that human struggle of the divine and the human so powerfully in a kind of a developmental tension that owns the full human being. And I think that that's profound, and it somehow is more powerful to me than the notion of being a kind of a perfect church where everybody's already in this place of pure equality in Zion. You know, the fact that we're all struggling together with our humanity is really powerful.
Just as God is struggling with all of humanity. Yeah. God, yeah. Anyway, thank you so much. Hey, you guys, amazing. Thank you. Thank you for last Tuesday night. Thank you for this Sunday night into the wee hours of the morning that we are. Everyone, this is 12:30 a.m. when we're finishing this up. So thank you for your stamina. Thanks for your good hearts. Listeners, please come to the blog and share your thoughts, your comments, your questions. Hope that everybody here will dive in as you ask specific things or whatever. Donate to the podcast when you're there, if you would. But I'll just close and wish everybody good night. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Dan.
Good night, Dan.
Thanks for organizing it, Dan.
Thank you.
You bet.
Bye.
Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.